In one set of experiments, women were judged much more negatively than men for engaging in the same self-promoting behaviors. And it's not just men who had that reaction, women did too. The more successful a man is, the more we like him. But the opposite is true for women. The more successful a woman is, the less we like her. I've seen it in the classroom for over a decade when I teach a case on Heidi Roizen. She's an entrepreneur who leverages her network to become a successful venture capitalist. Every year, both male and female students question her motives. When she connects people, is she really just out to gain status and advance her own career? Is she a taker? A couple of my colleagues were teaching the same case, and they noticed the same things. So they designed a little experiment where students read the exact same case study, but Heidi's name was changed to Howard. And that was enough to create a completely different reaction. Howard was judged as equally competent, but students liked him more. Heidi was seen as more selfish, more aggressive, and more self-promoting. Not the kind of person you'd want to hire or work for. Women are stereotyped as caring and communal. As a result, they get stuck doing the lion's share of the office housework, taking notes in meetings, planning events, organizing schedules. As Stuart Butterfield, the founder and CEO of Slack, put it,
there's an expectation that women will be of service, and their service is often unnoticed.
In a study of TSA screeners in airports, women were disproportionately assigned to pat-downs, instead of rotating from checking travel documents to monitoring exit lanes to screening baggage, which narrowed their skill development opportunities and limited their avenues for promotion. The same thing often happens in office settings when managers ask for volunteers to take on tasks that don't advance a career but need to get done. Say, planning an event or filling in for a sick colleague or sitting on a low-level committee. New research shows that women are more likely to be asked to take on these non-promotable tasks, and they're more inclined to say yes. Even if they do get promoted, studies show that women are about half as likely as men to benefit from career sponsorship, and they're also less likely to get advice and mentoring from senior leaders. And there's rigorous evidence that on corporate boards, new directors get more mentoring if they're men. For far too long, women have been denied access to the mentorship and sponsorship that men enjoy. They've been shut out of the bonding on business trips and bar crawls, the guidance given on golf courses. And now, women might be getting even less access. Lean In and SurveyMonkey recently ran a study about gender relations in the workplace. Almost half of male managers reported being uncomfortable mentoring women, socializing with them, or working alone with them. In the wake of the Me Too movement, the number of men who are afraid to mentor women has tripled.
And if this is the reaction to what's going on with Me Too, that's unacceptable, because we know that mentorship and sponsorship has been super important in male and female careers. We know that women get a lot less of it than men. We know that women of color get even less of it than white women. And we know it's critical to promotions.
That's Sheryl Sandberg, the chief operating officer of Facebook. She's the founder of Lean In, where I serve on the board, and we wrote Option B together. Not long after Davos, I talked with her about the Me Too movement.
Women are 6% of the Fortune 500 CEOs, 20% of the U.S. Congress. A lot of the way people get to those jobs is the one-on-one investment. And so we launched Mentor Her with a hashtag, because everything needs a hashtag these days. And we're calling on leaders everywhere to mentor women and to make access equal. So I think people should be able to have one-on-one meetings, behave appropriately. If you're not going to have dinner with women, don't have dinner with men. But we have to really pay attention to access being equal.
Mark Zuckerberg wrote a post about that, and he coined a term for this. He said it's the Sandberg rule, which I love. And it was kind of an aha moment for me, because, you know, I've actually heard from both men and women, right? This concern is coming up a lot. You know, people are afraid of being accused of harassment. Men are afraid of making women uncomfortable. And, you know, they don't want to be seen in a situation that might look inappropriate.
And it really matters. I mean, one of the most common reactions I got from senior men who read Lean In, which was published 5 years ago, I wrote about this, how men get more of the informal access. They get to go on the trips.
Trip.
They go to the
golf.
Dinners,
yeah.
The golf. But then who do you promote? They promote the guy you've spent the time with. And so not giving women the same access. And a lot of men said, you're right. I take the man on the business trip, not the woman. And that is why I promote. When a woman has a problem at work, I talk on the phone. When a man has a problem at work, I meet him and sit down and go through the paper with him. And so what we're saying very loudly and clearly is that we want to end sexual harassment now and forever. And a part of that is going to be getting more women into leadership roles, because not surprisingly, we know that organizations with more women who are more senior have less sexual harassment. We also know there's so many other reasons we want more women in leadership roles. higher productivity, better work-life policies, using the talents of the whole population. So the reaction to this movement needs to be to end sexual harassment now and forever, and to invest more in women, not less.
Of course, the burden doesn't only fall on men. Women need support from other women, too. And there's a lot of talk about women who don't do that. The queen bee who keeps other women out. The catty woman who's nasty to her own group. But the data show that queen bees and catty women don't actually cause inequality. They're a response to inequality. If you create a zero-sum world where there's a limit to the number of women who can get ahead, then those few women are going to protect their turf. Those zero-sum worlds still exist for many women. In a systematic study of the S&P 1500 firms over two decades, strategy researchers found that there's an implicit quota on the number of women in top management. When one woman breaks the glass ceiling, the odds of another woman making the top management team go down by half. But the odds improve if the CEO is a woman, which is the opposite of what the queen bee theory would predict. You can see the quota on boards of directors, too. There's a recent study showing that they're not stopping at having one woman, but after two, the odds go dramatically down that a third woman will join. So instead of having tokens, we now have toucans. Executives know if their board only has one woman, it'll look like they're just checking a box, that they're not taking the issue seriously. But if you got two, you can wave a flag saying, look, we care about women around here. And then sadly, it looks like no more women need apply. Laura Liswood has been seeing it for years.
They think about diversity in a Noah's Ark way, which is, God, if we could only just get two of each in the ark, you know, we'll have our diversity. Yeah. And most organizations are still in that, let's just get two of each kind of thing. You know, and as I often say, you know, when the problem is that when the giraffe looks at the zebra, you know, and goes, God, you're funny looking. You know, how do you do anything with that stupid short neck of yours? You know, it doesn't matter that you've got Noah's Ark. So the problem is that we get to Noah's Ark, you know, we get two of each, but then we don't teach people how to deal with, you know, the giraffe and the zebra kind of thing.
There are steps we can take to change that dynamic, and it starts when girls are young. After Ellen Stofan finished her term as chief scientist at NASA, she helped design an American girl doll who's aspiring to be an astronaut on Mars.
Her name is Luciana Vega, and she's Chilean-American. And what I really loved about the character and through the books that are developed around the character is, you know, she fails. She's not perfect. She struggles. And I think that, to me, that's actually also the story of NASA. We don't always succeed. But if you're aiming for Mars, you got to keep going. You got to pick yourself up.
The idea is that from the very beginning, girls should have female role models with scientific ambitions.
I think girls have to be encouraged. They have to be encouraged by, and the research has shown this, you have to be encouraged by your family. You have to be encouraged by your teachers. And you have to be welcomed. And I think we've seen, you know, it's an entire pipeline problem. So I've even run into women who say, why are you encouraging girls to go into STEM fields when they get into those fields or they get into graduate school and they're harassed or they're not treated well or they're made to feel not welcome? But to me, we've got to keep the pipeline going and we've got to attack all the different problems in the pipeline. We've got to make sure that universities are inclusive environments for women. We've got to make sure workplaces are welcoming and inclusive. We can't just tackle one part of the problem. We've got to look along the pipeline and tackle all the problems.
Recently, a physicist conducted research showing that if you want to encourage women to pursue STEM careers, having female role models is not enough. What moves the needle is discussing the problem of underrepresentation itself. When you raise awareness of the shortage of women going into science, high school women become more interested in that career path.
I think it is critical because, you know, and I've seen another study where all they did was to make sure that girls were praised. And that was enough to get girls to stick with it. I think, again, I think you can't underestimate the overwhelming message girls are getting from society of, you don't belong in science, you don't belong in engineering, you don't belong in technology. They're just getting that message from everywhere. So when they're told, hey, this is actually a problem, all of a sudden they say, oh, wait a minute, I just thought that's the way it was. I didn't realize I was even an option. And so to me, what you're doing is saying to a girl, it's an option, and by the way, you're welcome. And I think that makes a huge difference. It's these small things that we find are actually really making a difference.
When I first started teaching at Wharton, there was a shortage of women applying for leadership roles on campus, like student government and running clubs. So my colleagues convinced me to share the data in the classroom. We were hoping that it would motivate more women to lean in and that more men and women would step up to advocate for women in leadership roles. But it did no good whatsoever. Over the next 5 months, there was no change in the percentage of female MBA students who sought out leadership roles on campus. So the next year, I shared the same data, but I added a sentence. I said, I don't ever want to see this happen again. In the next 5 months, the number of female MBA students who applied for leadership positions spiked by 65%. And the women who were in the classroom where I made that statement were more than half as likely to apply for leadership roles than women who took a different class, who were basically a control group. I learned that when talking about women in leadership, you have to be careful, because acknowledging biases can backfire. In one experiment, after being told stereotypes were common, people rated women as significantly more family-oriented and less career-oriented. In another experiment, when a woman asked for higher pay at the end of a job interview, people who had been told stereotypes were common were less interested in hiring her and they liked her less. When you learn most people are biased, it doesn't feel like prejudice. It's just the norm. The key step is to highlight that biases are not just common, they're unacceptable. If you find out that most people want to overcome the stereotypes they hold, you don't discriminate anymore against an assertive woman. You end up excited to hire her, and you like her too. Recently, California passed a law mandating that any public company based in the state must have at least one female board member by 2019, and at least two or three, depending on board size, by mid-2021. It's a practice that started a decade ago in Norway, where boards must be at least 40% female.
Aaron Deere's work on corporate boardrooms about Norway, he looked at governance processes. Amongst the findings he found, right, with this 40% women on the boards now, with the Norwegian quota, one thing was that women read the board materials.
I've seen that so many times.
Right.
The unprepared man just spouting uninformed opinions.
But
the woman who's actually done the homework. Right.
But here's the thing, what they have observed is that the men now come to the board.
Prepared.
Prepared.
So they actually, they picked up the norm.
They picked, yes, the
minority
presence
drove the
of the non-dominant group raised the performance of the dominant group.
How interesting.
Yeah, which that I thought was interesting. Then they found that more of the board decisions are made in the boardroom, not nightclub, golf course, country club. Right. Then they found that women ask more questions, which created the dynamic of conflict in longer board meetings and going back to the management and all of that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
They found that men had a tendency to look at the short-term impact, board decisions. Women had a tendency to look at the long-term impact. But, of course, best boards look at short-term and long-term.
Yeah.
Men had a tendency to look at the shareholder impact. Women had a tendency to look at the stakeholder impact, employees, environments, communities, best boards, shareholder and stakeholder.
Yeah.
So it's just a really interesting controlled experiment.
If old power was command and control, new power is more about collaborate and learn. Sometimes women usher in that shift. Other times, they get their foot in the door because of that shift. But all it takes is a handful of leaders, managers, or mentors to open the door. That's the subject of the next chapter, empowerment. But first, some power tips on gender and negotiation. In a famous study of MBA grads, men had 7.6% higher starting salaries than women. Why? Only 7% of the women asked for higher salaries, while 57% of the men did. And negotiating raised the average starting salary by 7.4%, which basically erased the gender gap. Over a 35-year career, the decision not to negotiate cost the average woman over $1 million. We know that for women to gain power, one of the key skills is negotiating. Not just for promotions, but for challenging assignments and access to mentors and sponsors. Not to mention getting men to do their share of the office housework. But women often hesitate to negotiate or lobby for leadership roles. And for good reason. The backlash is real. There's a lot of evidence that women who negotiate are liked less. They often get judged as aggressive and self-promoting, because apparently they've violated the gender stereotype of women being caring and communal. What does it take to overcome that bias? All right, I don't want to mansplain here. But there are three strong points from evidence that my female students have used successfully. They work for men too, they're just even more important for women. First, recognize that any complex negotiation has multiple issues. In a job offer, the issues might include pay, title, bonus, location, and start date. Instead of just making one ask, come in with two or three combinations of options that are appealing to you. So you might put one option on the table with a high bonus and an undesirable location, and then a second option with no bonus, but your ideal location. The goal is to set them up so they're equally attractive to you, and that way you can learn where your counterpart is willing and able to give, and where they're not. Plus, you get to be assertive with your requests while still signaling that you're flexible and open to considering lots of different possibilities. Sure enough, there's a series of experiments showing that when you present multiple offers simultaneously, you're more likely to get what you want, you appear more accommodating, and you're more likely to reach win-win outcomes. Second, instead of negotiating for yourself, try negotiating on behalf of others. In an experiment with job offers, men secured 3% higher salaries than women. But if they were representing a mentee instead of themselves, women negotiated 14% higher salaries than men. It's been demonstrated over and over. When women negotiate on behalf of others, they do just as well as men, if not better. They're willing to push harder because they don't feel like they're violating gender stereotypes. Advocating for others is being caring and communal. And for that reason, they're liked more too. So in your next negotiation, you don't necessarily need someone to bargain for you. It just helps to remind yourself and the person across the table who you're representing. Your family, your employees, your company, or a cause that matters to you. Third, sometimes you don't have to make demands. You can ask for advice instead. Let's say you want a promotion. Find someone senior in your workplace, describe your goal, and say, "I really admire your track record for navigating dilemmas in this place, and I'd love your guidance on how to pursue it." Research suggests that advice seeking is a neglected strategy for influence. It makes people feel good to be asked for advice. Let's face it, you have great taste. You knew to come to me. It also makes you look smarter, and it forces that person to take your perspective, because they have to look at the problem from your viewpoint in order to give a recommendation, which makes them more likely to help you. And that might mean advocating for you, lobbying for you, or just recommending you for a position that will help you move in the direction you want to go. Worst case scenario, you get some useful suggestions. Just one caveat. It only works if you're genuinely interested in learning from the person's advice. If you ask with a manipulative goal, they can usually see right through it. Chapter 4, Team Power.
We had a fun discussion in Sao Paulo about how you don't call people employees necessarily.
Yeah.
What do you call them?
In Portuguese, it's colaboradores.
So collaborators?
Collaborators, yeah.
It's such a different way to think about the employment relationship. I imagine that's a much more empowering way to lead than, you know, if they are people that you essentially have an ownership role over.
Yeah. So I think this is one of the most important leadership lessons that I've learned is you have to give people guidance, but you have to give them empowerment and you have to give them room to operate. Otherwise, they feel castrated. Does that word exist in English?
Okay, yes, yeah. It exists exactly the way you said it.
That's Claudia Sender, the president of LATAM Airlines. Claudia has 25,000 people working for her. 5 years ago in her mid-30s, she became one of the youngest CEOs in Brazil's airline industry. It's a role that thrusts her directly into many of the most difficult situations a corporate leader can face, like massive reorganizations, layoffs, and life-or-death safety decisions, in one of the most rigid and traditionally hierarchical industries. We're sitting outside the promenade, so those sounds you're hearing, that's people trudging through the snowy sidewalks on their way to meetings and events.
A lot of the people who worked with me, who were in my team, most of them were a lot older and had a lot more experience in airlines than I did. You know, I came into the company in a very crucial moment, which was a merger, right? And a merger of different cultures, different countries, and two really big companies who had very different ways of operating. I think the key asset that helped me be successful in this role is, you know, listening to people. So the first thing that I realized is that I would never know as much about their thing as they did. So I was always very humble on how I approached them. So I think that was a major shift because airlines are very hierarchical. You know, pilots have a checklist.
Yeah, and the stripes
and
on the shoulder.
And the stripes on your shoulder, and you do what I say. And I was never like that because I knew I would never know as much as they did. And I think that was a significant change in the company, being a lot less hierarchical, a lot more open, and a lot closer to our employees. I think I have a very different leadership style than most leaders in our country and especially in our industry.
What Claudia is describing is empowerment, giving people broader responsibilities and more authority to make decisions. And in a time of network power, when employees demand more transparency and agency, leaders that fail to empower their teams do so at their own peril. In a study of more than 300 manufacturing companies across two decades in the UK, researchers tracked the productivity effects of adopting different kinds of management practices. Operations programs like just-in-time production and total quality management didn't lead to any consistent gains in productivity. What did? Empowerment programs. Productivity spiked when companies gave responsibility for operations to individuals and teams, instead of leaving decisions in the hands of management. When people are empowered, they're more likely to step up and fix mistakes, instead of saying, "That's not my job." They're also more likely to prevent mistakes, too, because they take the initiative to learn what caused them in the first place. And recent evidence shows empowerment is not just a Western phenomenon. When leaders in the United Arab Emirates were encouraged to delegate more projects to employees and consult them on decisions, their employees not only performed better on their tasks, they were also more likely to bring new ideas and suggestions to the table. It's part of the broader evolution of power from hierarchies into networks. Employees are demanding more voice, and leaders are trying to figure out how to provide it while still achieving organizational goals. Which is why empowerment has its share of skeptics. Some scholars have criticized empowerment initiatives as smokescreens, calling them therapeutic fictions that trick employees into believing they have a say when it's still leaders who determine what they have a say about. Real empowerment means consulting employees in important decisions even when you don't think you need their input, which is what Claudia Sender learned shortly after she took the reins of her airline in Brazil.
Right after I became the CEO, we were reshuffling some functions within my direct reports. And I decided to move one area from one vice president to another, and I communicated them. So the guy who lost that particular area, he came to me and said, "You know what, I agree with your decision. I think you're doing the right thing. But I'm really pissed that you didn't talk to me before, that you didn't have this conversation with me, because I think I should have been part of the decision." So I kept quiet. We finished the meeting in a really weird way. I called him the next day, and he came to my office, and I said, "You know what? I wanted to say I'm sorry. I made a mistake, and I promise you I will never do that again, and I will consult with you again." So he left my office, and at the end of the day, I got this. Like, this is a super senior guy, 15 years my senior, has been doing airline work for 25 years. I was there for 3. He sends me this super long email saying, "You know, I've had six CEOs before you. No one has ever said he was sorry." And you just, and although I still think that you didn't do the right thing at first, you just gained my respect and my trust forever, because you are the first person senior to me who recognizes you did something fundamentally wrong and said it out loud. So it means the world to me. And I didn't realize how much the word "I'm sorry" coming from someone who's hierarchically above you mean to someone in your team. I didn't have that conscience then, but I do have today. So I become a lot more deliberate. It wasn't deliberate at the time, but I become a lot more deliberate now on recognizing my mistakes.
There are some leaders who fail to understand that. They view an apology as a sign of weakness.
Absolutely.
You don't see it that way.
No, I don't. And I think people trust you more when they relate to you. And if they see you as perfect, they will never relate to you. So what I try to do all of the time is tell people the things that I did that didn't go that well, or my flaws as a human being.
I've heard similar sentiments from plenty of CEOs. Many workplaces don't even have offices anymore. Employees expect their superiors to be human and approachable. And more, bosses are realizing that they not only have to be more approachable to their employees, they also have a lot to learn from them. So the relationship between employer and employee is more of a two-way street. The challenge for many managers, then, is figuring out the rules of the road, how much authority and agency their employees should get and when.
So I get a lot of emails from customers who are not happy. And one of the things that I did at the beginning was I replied myself. And then I started notice, and I went after the solution. And I started noticing that people got very complacent because they're like, well, if you're going to do it, if you're going to solve it, what's my role here? So I think when you make people accountable, you know, this is the case. Please find a solution and let me know what you did. But let me know what you did. You're empowering the person. You're telling me, hey, this is really important. This is a customer who's not happy with us. So you're giving the important message, but you're not doing their job.
Of course, you can't empower every team on every decision. Research suggests it's more important to empower people when decisions are consequential and you need their buy-in and their expertise.
In general, I tend to ask more questions than give the answers, but sometimes you need to step up and make the decisions.
Yeah.
And I think the moments when I had to make more decisions are the moments where there were more risks involved and people didn't feel comfortable in taking the decisions,
right.
The decisions themselves.
We know that rigid hierarchies can stifle problem solving. When people are afraid to speak their minds and challenge their superiors, innovation becomes more rare and mistakes become more common. One of the strongest examples of this is in the cockpit of an airplane.
The main safety issues will happen inside the cockpit, and you need to make sure that people feel comfortable challenging one another. And if the co-pilot didn't report a behavior that put the plane at risk or the flight at risk, then both of them will suffer the consequences.
Researchers have been able to predict a flight's safety, timeliness, and fuel efficiency just by watching the first 15 minutes of the captain's introduction to the crew. The effective captains create psychological safety. They make it clear that they won't punish anyone who questions them.
They create this openness,
yes,
where the rest of the crew feel that they can bring their issues to them.
This is a philosophy that leaders in any industry can adopt. Empowering leadership is about giving people responsibility for their work. Or in the case of pilots or astronauts, also taking responsibility for their lives.
People really undermine themselves. They can get in a position where it seems like their best option is to protect their position, is to withhold power, withhold information, and use that selective visibility to increase their power in the organization.
That's Stuart Butterfield again, the founder and CEO of Slack, the workplace messaging platform. They help companies move from private email inboxes to more open channels where more people can access information. Sharing information can empower employees up and down the ladder, but when held back, siloed, and distributed to only a select few, it can have the opposite effect.
And in the context of business, because there's, you know, employers and employees have a very different power structure, there can be a lot of coercive power. So like the insistence that you do something and the threat behind that of, if you don't do this thing, then you're fired or you will get a negative performance review and things like that. And then there's many, many other senses of power, the kind of soft influence that people have, the enlisting people in supporting your project because you're a great storyteller. And then there's also, because humans are very attuned to power and maybe even more so to fairness. There's a real desire to, like, if you're not invited to a meeting, you're like, I wonder what's going on there. That's probably super important. I wish I was invited to that meeting. And if you are invited to the meeting, you're like,
I don't want to be here. Get me out of here.
This is crazy and this is a waste of time. So there's a lot of curiosity about things that are outside of our vision, like what's happening behind closed doors. And Slack opens a lot of doors internally. So I think that feeling of comfort and empowerment is really real and tangible for a lot of people using it.
Half a century ago, psychologists identified five different bases of power. Stuart mentioned the first one, coercive power. That's influence based on threats and punishments. Second is reward power, which is using the ability to offer incentives. Third is legitimate power, influence based on your position or title. Fourth is referent power, which is influence based on being liked or admired. And fifth is expert power, influence based on your knowledge and skills. Stop there, and you have five different ways to gain and wield influence. But several years later, they added a sixth base of power, informational power. It sounds like expert power, but it's not tied to your competence. It's the ideas, opinions, and facts you collect by virtue of where you sit and who you happen to meet. Think of executive assistants. They have incredible informational power due to their access to and control over the inboxes, phones, and calendars of senior leaders. It seems to me that what Slack is doing is giving everyone that kind of informational power. Informational power is becoming more critical as work becomes more project-based. In the knowledge and service economy, people don't just have one job. They get to work on lots of different projects, often in multiple teams. They need information in their hands so they can move up the learning curve, innovate, and solve problems. That's a big deal at IDEO, a global design and innovation consultancy that exclusively does project-based work, like designing the mouse for Apple.
Indeed. We were fortunate enough to get to work with Steve Jobs on the mouse, actually originally for the Lisa computer.
Oh, wow.
Then the Mac. But we also were fortunate enough to work on the design of the first ever laptop, first automatic defibrillator, first digital cell phone. I mean, so a lot of those sort of early things that we now treat, some of them have gone away again, but like, you know, my first project as a designer was to design fax machines, and my daughters don't even know what a fax machine is. So some of it was a bit ephemeral. Some of it had a little more lasting power.
That's Tim Brown. He's the CEO of IDEO, and he believes that creativity happens when teams are empowered.
You can't teach what we do top down. I mean, it's like, you can't teach the piano in a classroom. You can't teach the skills of innovation and creativity in a classroom. It's a different kind of learning process. And so the only way to do that is directly with the people you want to learn. And so we're very comfortable with working at whatever levels of the organization will benefit from learning this stuff. And it turns out, by the way, that the younger and often kind of those who've not been with the organization so long are much more willing to adapt and learn anyhow, not surprisingly. But you still need the support and sponsorship at the top of the organization. Because the top of the organization may not be able to cause change, could certainly kill change.
Yeah.
Over the years, Tim has come to believe that delegating isn't the only way to be an empowering leader. Giving your team more responsibility can empower them, but so can taking on unexpected responsibility yourself.
I look at somebody like Jim Hackett, for instance, who, you know, recently took on the role of CEO of Ford. And I've worked with him for 20 years.
Wow.
And He gives away his power not by, you know, delegation or in this, but by turning up in the places where it's his thoughtfulness that's valuable, not his power that's valuable, right? So he turns up in the room when we're trying to figure out what the right direction to go is. He turns up in the room when we're struggling with the tough questions about, you know, how do we help or the business transform in some way, or how do we think about the future in some way? So there's a way of giving away power, as I say, not through delegation, but through just being there when it matters, and it's the whole kind of rolling up the sleeves and working at the same level as everybody else, not acting as the decision maker, but as a contributor with a very different perspective.
In most workplaces, you have a boss who decides what you work on and who you work with. At IDEO, project leaders are empowered to recruit people for teams and roles. I asked him what makes someone a desirable teammate, and he said that first and foremost, it's a track record of being a giver.
Anybody who walks into an interview and says "I" more than they say "we," probably they're going to have a problem at IDEO. Right, because if they need to claim personal responsibility and authorship for everything they do, they're going to get frustrated because a lot of people are going to argue with them about that. And two, you know, they're not going to be helping other people much. People tend to get a following when they help other people. And I mean, and you know, the earliest version of that was whenever anybody was forming a project team, and they would tend to ask for the people that were most helpful to them. Right, and so if you got asked to join a lot of project teams, it was generally a pretty good indication.
Wait, hold on. I can just ask anyone I want to join my team.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, if you're a project leader, you don't necessarily get them if they're busy doing other things. But the kind of the marketplace for staffing projects in IDEO is always, you know, who does the project leader want to have on their team?
Are you hiring?
We're always hiring.
It's just such a different way of thinking about organizing, right? Normally, I report to a boss and I do the tasks that person assigns,
yeah.
as opposed
yeah.
to I can join a project yeah. team that sounds interesting.
Well, I mean, that's a great thing about a project-oriented organization is that your boss, if you're a designer or an engineer or whatever you might be, is your project leader for the length of that project. And then you get another one, another boss. And then eventually you become that boss because you're the project leader for a while. So that sort of marketplace for people who are useful and helpful to you tends to, you know, indicate who's got a following, who's helpful. And influence comes more that way than it does from any sort of positional power. In fact, one of the challenges at IDEO is that the more theoretically, the more positional power you have, the less influence you have.
One of the challenges of building power through generosity is that people outside your project often aren't aware of who you are and what you bring to the table. To change that dynamic, IDEO gathers people together to share their stories.
We have this kind of ritual at IDEO that's a bit of a rite of passage for people. We have something called, literally called IDEO Stories, and we ask people, and we run one about every quarter. It's very, we ask people to come stand up in front of their whole studio and tell a personal story about themselves in a way that really helps people engage. And it's like...
You're hazing them, but fun.
But in a fun way. And people have told things about themselves in these moments that they've never told a family member or they've never told anybody else ever. And they've dug down really deep and they've somehow expressed what that experience meant to them. And it's completely unlocked something for them. Huh. And so it's a very difficult thing to do. It takes a lot of coaching. We have a lot of expert storytellers who really work with them for weeks beforehand to get them ready to stand up and tell this story. But it's a pretty powerful moment. And I think something like that might be something that other organizations might try.
I've actually tried a version of it in the classroom at Wharton. Every fall, I invite my undergrads to pitch ideas for a new class session. 2 years ago, the winning idea was Passion Talks, giving any student who is interested the chance to give a one-minute talk about something they love. We had one student introduce us to environmental architecture, another taught the whole class to beatbox. They were such a hit that last fall, I asked every student to give one. It was a real highlight of the semester, and not just because the talks were frequently fascinating and moving and entertaining. It fostered an environment where students seemed to feel empowered to share their personal interests and voice their ideas. I noticed that after giving a passion talk, some of the especially quiet students started coming out of their shells, and it empowered others to reach out to them. Students said they came to see one another less as achievement robots and more as approachable human beings. It can work in any environment. In an experiment at a call center in India, a few of my colleagues randomly assigned new employees to one of three groups. The control group just went to regular orientation. The second group talked with their new team about how they could fit into the company. The third group got to express themselves, what was unique about them personally, and who they were at their best. 6 months later, that last group was more effective. They had higher customer satisfaction, and they were more likely to stick around. Sharing their story opened the door to using their strengths and building strong connections. Empowerment isn't just a strategic decision. It's a moral decision to respect the dignity and freedom of people and help them grow. Power tips, empowering teams. Empowering leadership breaks down into three key behaviors. The first is expanding the scope of employees' responsibilities. If you really want to empower them, you have to ask them what challenges they want to take on. My colleagues and I did that in a project at Google, where employees got to make a plan for bringing more of their own strengths to the table, and they got to choose new strengths that they wanted to develop. Over the next 6 months, they became significantly happier and more effective in their jobs. Second, try involving employees more in decisions, especially the ones that affect them. For example, if you have a suggestion box, don't just ask leaders to evaluate which ones to adopt. Ask your employees which ones are worth pursuing. Evidence suggests that coworkers are often better judges than managers of which new ideas will take off because they're more open to novelty and they're less likely to reject ideas that seem risky or break the mold of what's worked in the past. And research shows that employees appreciate having a say even if they don't get their way. It's a chance to express their values. You don't have to go along with their recommendations as long as you make it clear that their input was considered and explain why you made the decision you did. Third, show employees that their work matters. Building on one of Tim Brown's points, there's a creative way to highlight the importance of the work that employees do. You can show up and actually do some of it yourself. My colleague Sigal Barsade calls it leading by doing and recommends that leaders spend up to 10% of their work time on it. It's kind of like undercover boss, only it's an ongoing commitment. It helps you understand what your employees actually do, and it reduces power distance. It's also a natural opportunity to see who's interested in what kind of expanded role. Chapter 5, Culture Change.
That is a hobby that I pursue, on the weekends for fun, kind of once a month.
That's David Solomon. Recently, there was an article about him in the New York Times, about an identity he'd managed to keep hidden until now.
Well, it's a weird hobby.
You didn't mean for that to get out, did you?
Well, certainly my friends and people I'm close to have known, you know, that I've done this for a number of years. I guess I'm not surprised when you get into a position with visibility that you're at times, you know, things in your personal life get out.
David's secret identity, he's a DJ. He's known as DJ D-Sol. When the story broke, he was pretty nervous that people at work were going to make fun of him.
The thing that was amazing is all the people in our organization and all the clients that I'm connected to around the world, people started reaching out saying, this is really awesome. Let me tell you about my hobby. And,
really?
And it's so great to see somebody who's, you know, clearly very focused on their professional life, but at the same point pursuing passion, you know, outside the professional life. And what I've found that's kind of interesting, I think it's, you know, it's helping to humanize our organization, because yes. Our organization, at the end of the day, we're all people. We're trying to do very well professionally. We're trying to live our life, be good people, contribute to our communities, to society. And, you know, when you get messages from people in a big organization saying, you know, this really inspires me, you know, to work hard and pursue my passion, you know, that's an exciting thing.
What makes this so surprising is David's profession. He's an investment banker. And not at just any company, at Goldman Sachs, a blue chip bank that's a century and a half old. And not in just any role, he's the new CEO.
Wall Street has this reputation for, you know, if you want to gain power and have a successful career, then you need to work all the time and only be focused on work. And you also, I think, are sending this message, no, you can have a life too.
Yeah, I think it's fair that historically finance has had a reputation, you know, like that. But I think also in fairness, you know, the world's changed a lot. I started in the business in the early 1980s and the world was a very different place. And, you know, there's no question, you know, the ethos around the explosion of finance in the 80s and 90s, you know, led to a culture that certainly, you know, promoted that.
I met David 5 years ago when he was the co-head of investment banking at Goldman. They hired me to help them figure out how to recruit and retain junior analysts and associates. In the past, firms had all the power. Tons of smart people wanted to work for a top investment bank, and Goldman was at the very top of the hierarchy. They offered the most prestige, the most pay, and the chance to move entire markets. But now there was a war for talent. David kept seeing college seniors get lured away by tech companies. And people who joined Goldman and were high performers, in the past they might have spent entire careers there, but now they were jumping ship after 2 years to become entrepreneurs. The internet and social media had made it easier for them to find out what opportunities were available elsewhere. The power dynamic had flipped.
You recognize that because, you know, you depend so much on motivated, talented people, your junior employees had power in the sense that they could walk out the door or they could choose not to join in the first place.
Yes, they could.
And
that's
so,
that is absolutely a form of power. And by the way, that's one of the things that's changed in this connected, transparent world is, you know, people have a lot more power, a lot more choice, and a lot more transparency to kind of understand, you know, what their options are. The world's changed. The world's much more competitive, much more transparent. I think finance has changed. I think to be successful and attract talent, which is so important, you know, in any business today, you know, you've got to create an environment where people have lots of opportunity, where working hard is really valued, where accomplishments are rewarded and recognized, but also where the holistic or total aspect of people's lives is embraced, their obligations, their families, their passions. And, you know, I think that's a good thing for society. I think it's a good thing for business.
When Goldman brought me in, the message was clear to everyone. Time for some culture change. But even when you're a powerful person at the head of a powerful organization, changing a culture is a tall order. What exactly needs changing? Where do you start? And who has the power to make the change real? Answering these tough questions is a rite of passage for any successful company. And the stakes are higher today than ever. Change with the times or become irrelevant and die. But in a time of network power, you can no longer just fire off a memo. You need to make employees part of the solution. David Solomon had some ideas about how to respond to the rise in power among talented young people. Senior leaders knew the goal, attract and hold on to those people. But they weren't sure where the current culture at Goldman was falling short in drawing them and keeping them. So I spent a good chunk of the summer gathering data, interviews and surveys, observations and experiments. And one of the ahas was that senior leaders had burned the midnight oil while rising up the ranks, but when they left the office, they were able to unplug. In a digital world, this just wasn't happening anymore.
I worked very hard when I was a young analyst, but for good or for bad, you walked out of that office, nobody could get a hold of you. There were no cell phones. Yeah. There were no pagers. Nobody could get a hold of you. And if they called you at home, you didn't have to answer the phone. You let your answering machine pick up. You could screen the call.
You did that?
Sure. Nobody could get a hold of you. So you might have worked very, very hard, but the moment you walked out of that office, you were independent to pursue your life and other things that were interesting to you until you walked back into the office. And, you know, in the context, you know, of that, you know, for a young person, it set boundaries. So then the world becomes with texting and cell phones, or whatever, email 24/7, everybody's in touch. Everybody has to respond immediately. Yeah. And you're 22 years old and you're out of school and you don't know how to manage that yet. You haven't developed the skills to manage that when more powerful people are, you know, in some way saying, I need this, I need that.
Yeah.
And when you and I started talking and we looked at that, we said the power is out of balance here.
Yeah.
I mean, that's fundamentally what we said. The power is out of balance here in this relationship. And so we have to do some things to change the relationship. And, you know, look, it was not easy to kind of break some glass, but it just became very apparent to me if we wanted to continue to be one of the organizations that really attracted incredible people out of school. And, you know, we've worked hard at that. And I think we still are an organization that really attracts incredible people out of school. We had to change some things radically.
After collecting and analyzing all the data, I came back with 26 recommendations. One was to set limits on weekend work, which can be a real challenge in knowledge jobs, when there are always more analyses you can run. There was no shortage of resistance from powerful people. They had a long list of counterarguments. And my advice was to stop debating and start experimenting. Because if you don't run experiments, you can't learn.
People jumped up and down and people said this would never work. But we said, you know, we're going to try it. And if it doesn't work, we'll adjust it.
So they ended up making a radical move. They banned work on Saturdays. Unless you were on a live deal, you couldn't badge into the building or log into the network from 9 p.m. Friday to 9 a.m. Sunday.
When we did that, I think that you know, it kind of shocked people, and it was a little bit of shock and awe. And the way I described it is we had to change the culture, and sometimes to change the culture in an organization, you have to hit the organization across the side of the head with a 2x4.
Yeah.
Okay, and that was an example.
That was more than a 2x4.
Yeah, that was an example of that, you know, of that kind of experience. But look, what I think it did is it started a narrative around the fact that we really do care about the quality of life and the experience that people who come to work here have, that we're committed to helping set up parameters and have better communication around what's expected and what's needed to be successful. And it allowed people to think, you know, I can do this and work hard and get a lot out of it. Because, by the way, I think we offer a great value proposition, both from an education, a development perspective, and, you know, an opportunity perspective in coming to work at Goldman Sachs, whether you stay for a few years or you stay for a career. But it gave people the confidence, you know, I can pursue this. I can enjoy my life. I can have friends. Yeah, I should be working hard if I'm really motivated because I'm right out of school and this is the time I could do this. I should be, you know, I should be doing that, but I can do it with more balance now. And, you know, I think those messages, you know, got overwhelmed and the Saturday thing, you know, continues fundamentally, but it's not the focus. The focus is, you know, we care about our people. We want our people to succeed. We want them to be able to manage their time. We want them to understand what's expected of them. And, you know, we've come a long way from where we were 10 years ago.
There were some kinks to work out. People pulling all-nighters during the week to cover for the weekend, some managers skirting the rules. But overall, they found it was easier to attract and retain analysts in a culture where people were encouraged to disconnect, to have lives outside work. But jobs needed to change too. No matter how good you get at setting boundaries, if people don't find the work itself meaningful and motivating, attraction and retention will still be a problem. We started with an activity called the job crafting exercise. It's a process of designing a more ideal but still realistic vision of your job, created by my colleagues Jane Dutton, Amy Resnesky, and Justin Berg. You start by mapping out the building blocks of your current job. If you break down your week, what tasks and interactions are responsible for most of your time and energy? And then you take a step back and you ask, what are my interests, strengths, and values, and how can I incorporate those into my job? So you come out with an image of a better job. a better job for you, but also one that allows you to serve your team's goals or your organization's goals. Before Goldman, we'd done this exercise at a Fortune 500 tech company, and we found that it increased employees' happiness and job performance for at least 6 weeks, and often up to 6 months. And we noticed that there were certain kinds of tasks that most people wanted to add or drop. So at Goldman Sachs, we asked 20 analysts and associates to just go through the exercise, and we analyzed the patterns and made word clouds to highlight the key themes. The two most common interests were learning and problem solving. And the one word that came up most frequently in the tasks that people added, client. Junior bankers wanted more opportunities to learn and grow, and they wanted to spend more time with clients to actually see the impact of their work. So enriching jobs in those ways became one of the avenues toward creating a culture where people wanted to come and stay. But there was still a lingering question about how to retain high performers. There's a lot of evidence that performance is a source of power. If you're a star, you attract more attention and you have a stronger network, which translates into more opportunities to leave. At Goldman, though, stars weren't more likely to leave across the board. It depended what kind of school they went to. When we analyzed 9 years of their data, we found that if you went to an Ivy League school, the better you performed, the more likely you were to leave. If you went to a state school, the better you performed, the more likely you were to stay. When state school graduates achieved top marks at Goldman, they were more likely to be grateful to the firm. They saw their success as a product of the place, not just their own personal traits. They were stars in that setting. They were valued at Goldman, so they wanted to stick around. When Ivy League grads excelled, they took it as a sign they had the power to move on to greener pastures. I always knew I was amazing, and this just confirms it. They attributed their success to their own qualities. So to shift the culture toward a norm of staying with the firm longer, David led an effort to diversify recruiting.
All these schools have really, really talented people. And if diversity is something that you're really focused on and striving for, you can build a much more diverse workforce by having a much wider aperture when you're looking at schools to recruit from. And then technology allows you the leverage to get to more places and connect with people much, much easier. And so instead of recruiting from a very, very narrow list of schools where the Ivy League schools were more dominant, we just opened it up and, you know, recruit much more broadly now. And we're finding great people and more diverse people and more interesting people. And, you know, it just creates a good mix. And we still recruit from the Ivy League schools and find great people from those schools. And so that's been a very, you know, the result of that was an examination, you know, of how to really continue to open up the opportunity set for us to have a really world-class workforce entering out of college.
At Goldman, structural changes were key to improving the culture. They changed when employees worked, they changed how jobs were designed, and they changed who they hired. Yet these kinds of structural changes are rarely enough to transform a culture, especially in a big organization. You actually have to shift the behaviors of your current employees, and you have to do it in a way that makes them feel empowered rather than left behind. Mary Barra has been working to do that at General Motors. She's a regular in Davos. That's where we first met. But she had a schedule conflict this year. So I invited her to Philly to talk with me and then interviewed her on stage at the Wharton People Analytics Conference. One of my favorite moments in Mary's leadership journey was during the time that she ran HR at GM. Their dress code was 10 pages. And she changed it to two words: dress appropriately.
Well, this was, we were just coming out of the restructuring, and I was working, our CEO at the time, Fritz Henderson, you know, a lot gets set aside when you're going through a restructuring and a bankruptcy process. And so it was an opportunity, though, to really define the culture that we wanted. And so we brainstormed, and so I said, okay, let's do the dress code. It's dress appropriately. The funny thing was, and this is kind of the side of HR, so then I had HR arguing with me. And they said, okay, it can be dressed appropriately, but here's what we're going to put in the manual. And it was like, don't wear T-shirts that have, you know, inappropriate sayings or, you know, like, well, is that appropriate? You know, why do I have to call that out? Because I think that's not appropriate. So I think, you know, dress appropriately. And it was this interesting, my first hurdle was actually with the HR team. And they kept, I finally had to say, no, it's two words. And that's all we want. And so, you know, I had this 8th-level manager write me this kind of scathing email of, you need to put out a better dress code policy. This is not enough. And so I called him. And, of course, that shook him a little bit. And I called him. I said, so help me. just let's talk. Help me understand. And he said, well, I don't think it's appropriate. And I said, okay, why? And it turned out occasionally that department at a very short notice had to deal with government officials and you know, he was worried that if they were in jeans or something, that wouldn't be appropriate. And I said, okay, well, why don't you talk to your team? I said, how, you know, what is your responsibility at the company? You know, established he was important for a pretty important part of the company, you know, multi-million dollar budget. And he called me back 2 weeks later. He said, I talked to my team. I told them what I was worried about. We brainstormed. They agreed for the 4 people that occasionally need to meet with government officials, they'll have a pair of, you know, dress pants in their you know, locker or whatever, and problem solved. And, you know, so to me, though, the big aha was you really needed to make sure your managers are empowered, because if they can't handle dress appropriately, what other judgment decisions are they not making? And I realized, you know, sometimes you can have a lot of policies and procedures that people will live down to, or then, you know, the manager can say, yeah, I don't agree with it either. If you make them own it, it really, especially at the first level of people supervision, it helps develop them. So it was eye-opening, but it's something that, you know, now it did, you know, small little things change the culture. It's not the only thing, but it contributed.
At first, I thought of Mary as a bureaucracy buster, but then I realized she was more of a bureaucracy master. She didn't come in and bulldoze a stupid rule. She changed it into a different kind of rule, one that granted freedom. Bureaucracy sounds like a barrier to change, but when you have power, you learn that it can actually be a resource for change. When people hear bureaucracy, they're usually thinking of red tape, restrictive rules that are used to control people. That's coercive bureaucracy. But sociologists have discovered that there's such a thing as an enabling bureaucracy. Rules don't have to be like curfews for teenagers. They can grant us permissions and give us rights. Like the school in England that authorizes its headmasters to graze their very own goats on school grounds. Or the law in Delaware that allows you to annul a marriage if you got hitched on a dare. Mary became CEO of GM in January 2014. And in her first month on the job, she found out an ignition switch defect in their cars had caused a number of crashes and deaths. Within a week, she announced recalls of more than 600,000 cars. And in the months that followed, they recalled almost 30 million cars worldwide, paid compensation for 124 deaths, and forfeited nearly $1 billion. That's when Mary was named Crisis Manager of the Year. I asked her about it on stage.
Well, immediately we formed a small team, and we met every day. And we quickly defined guiding principles based on our values. And so the first was, we're going to do everything possible for the customer. We're going to be transparent, and we're going to make sure we do everything in our power to make sure this never happens again. We're going to do the right thing even when it's hard. I mean, because when you have values, it's really easy to live your values when everything's going well. It's really hard when, you know, everyone's looking at you and, you know, it's dramatically impacting your financial results. But if the company knows and they see you do it and then every employee knows you're going to do the right thing even when it's hard, that to me is so important for me to trust that we're doing the right thing at every level every day.
I guess in the follow-up of handling this crisis, mm-hmm. What are the changes that you made, and what do you think has moved the needle the most on culture?
One of the things we did in late 14, so fairly new leadership team, most of us were in, even though we'd been at the company, we were in different seats because of the changes. And so in the fall of that year, our top 300 leaders from around the globe, we get together twice a year. The fall meeting, we asked everybody before they came to the meeting to do one thing and said, if you could change one behavior in the company, what would you change?
One of the real obstacles to culture change is that it feels daunting. By boiling the question down to one behavior, you make it manageable. In their book, Switch, which is my favorite read on change, Chip and Dan Heath call it shrinking the change.
And so they, you know, 300 responses come in, and it boiled down to about 5 things. And so we met for the day. We talked. We really had a dialogue of, you know, do we accept these are the things that we should do? And we left that day saying, tomorrow when we go to work, we are going to start demonstrating these behaviors. I and my president, we both stood up in front and said, if you see us not living these behaviors, call us out. Now, do it respectfully, but call us out. And I started to see change that day, because at that point, there was so much talk about General Motors culture, and it's not good. And I was like, how do I work on culture? Because to me, culture is the stories you tell about what happens at a company or an organization or a family or a country.
For years, I've made the same point to my students. If you want to gauge the culture of a company, instead of asking what it's like, ask people to tell you a story about something that happens there but wouldn't elsewhere. It's the Passover question. How is this organization different from all other organizations? If you collect enough stories, you can start to see patterns. When researchers did that in a classic study, they found that the same kinds of stories showed up in every organization. There's an organizational uniqueness bias. When we look at the culture of our own organization through a microscope, we think it's totally different from others. But when we zoom out, we realize that culture stories are answers to universal questions. Is the big boss human? Will I get fired? Can the little person get to the top? People want to know if this place is safe, if it's fair, and if they have some control. So as a leader trying to change culture, you can have influence by thinking carefully about which stories to tell. In an IT company, an experiment showed that the stories you tell to newcomers can influence how much giving and taking they do. Stories about people upholding the company's values led to giving behaviors, especially if they were about low-level employees living